What I have found in my tradition is this both very stark, you were never promised that the world would go on forever. You were never promised stable democracy, comfortable prosperity. What you were promised is that love is stronger than death.
Every spiritual tradition has had an element of sacrifice. And part of the reason we're in the predicament we're in today is because we are a culture that has eradicated all discomfort.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and I'm delighted today to be here with Sarah Wilson. And we're going to have a slightly different episode where we are in conversation with each other. We have both recently written books that are circling around really similar themes. What does it mean to be fully human, fully alive, interconnected, really living, even in these times that can feel so destabilizing and anxiety producing? Really delighted that she is here and has agreed for us to be able to chat to each other. So I'm going to start with the big, meaty, juicy question that I always kick off with, which is, what is sacred to you? What are the values you want to be guiding your life?
Oh, Elizabeth, look, firstly, it's wonderful to be here and to meet a kindred spirit and to do this interview in person, because so often we have to do it remotely.
Yep.
Eye contact is really sacred. I want to almost answer the question from two angles if I can, because in many ways what is sacred is what is the definition of sacred. And I think for me, so sacred is almost everything that is unknown, that the human brain, particularly the left brain, cannot grasp, and that which remains mysterious. And I think that in itself is a thing that actually guides the human spirit forward. There's this yearning, this ache to know that which our cerebral self does not know.
You called us meaning yearners, and I love that.
Yes. I mean, I feel it within myself. I am yearning forward. I can feel that that is what my spirit wishes to do. And the Greeks had a wonderful word, thumos. Thumos is this kind of almost like noble warrior-like desire to progress, and not the progress, the sense of the word as we know it today, which is about growth, which is highly problematic. It's this idea of expanding and bettering ourselves. But yeah, so I think the sacred is all of that which we, that leads us forward in our humanity. What is it for me personally? The sacred is whatever can connect me in and get me congruent with that sort of space between the things. And so nature would be number one. And the reason for that, I mean, I'll backtrack just a little bit. I want to actually answer these questions as best as I can, because it is such a cracking question. And I know you ask all your guests this question. I studied sort of quantum physics, philosophy of the universe in Santa Cruz when I was 21. And it was when quantum physics was really getting a little bit of traction, and there were consciousness thinkers, philosophers who were kind of connecting with the quantum physicists. And I remember my professor, David Chalmers, who came up with the concept of the hard problem of consciousness, and he's a leading robotics and AI thinker now with a spiritual kind of twist, so which is wonderful. But he pointed out that a lot of quantum physicists stall at what it is that is the energy that connects it all. You know, what is the original, what's the original thing? Yeah. And he said they struggle. And so the only word that they can come up with that is close to that sense of it is love, you know. So what is sacred to me is what connects me and gets me congruent with that life force, which could be called love. And yeah, for anyone listening, the feeling sometimes, I've got a laptop on my lap at the moment, but when you've got the cord on an Apple Mac and you connect it and it sort of schlups in, you know, that sort of, and it gets this like lovely connection. I know I shouldn't be using a piece of technology to describe this, but that is almost the sensation I get. So being in nature gets me there. I think the fractals that we observe in the trees and in the patternings of the fern fronds and the flowers, it actually replicates, you know, some of the fractals in our retinas, and there's this sense of belonging. That sense of belonging makes me feel like I'm part of something big, and that makes me connect with the awesome infinite.
Yeah, connection is a really a big thing for both of us, I think.
Yes.
We'll come back to it, but could you just give me a little picture of your childhood, little Sarah running around in the outback in Australia? What were the big ideas, or I guess maybe the big events or the background that formed you into the person you are today?
My childhood was formative. I think I came from a family, my parents were reasonably young when they had me. Mm. My dad moved us out to the country. He had read Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb. Mm. He had observed capitalism with Margaret Thatcher and Reagan. He got very disillusioned and he thought capitalism was coming to an end. Mm. He was fed up with, you know, what was really the beginnings of neoliberal thinking. Mm. The poor guy has had to witness it get just worse and worse and worse. So we moved out to the country to a semi-subsistence property. Unfortunately, and this is in Australia, it was in the middle of a drought and bushfires, like really, really destructive bushfires. So his big dream was crushed by those realities. And the irony was that they ran out of money. They couldn't afford to get water. So we had to import water in to survive and feed goats and us, you know. So my childhood, I was the eldest of six kids, and I suppose, and it was very frugal. Mm. And yeah, it. I think by today's standard, as people would say, poor, but very, very resourceful. And it became just part of my mindset. And I think people who've grown up that way, you either go one way or the other. You either become a raging capitalist, you know, or you sort of stay true to that kind of way of thinking. And all of my siblings have stayed true. Mm. And we often talk about it. It's kind of, we're actually quite lazy. Like, it is actually easier to not spend money, to not go to the shops, to fix things rather than go and research the new version of something, to go without and actually practice going without as a mindset for living a full life, you know? Yeah. And you've probably realized I've had a fairly funny past, some might say hypocritical, but to me it wasn't. I was the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine when I was 29. I sold shit to women that they did not need, you know? That's what I did. However, I did it in such a way where I was wearing secondhand clothes. I rode a bike, even though I had a, you know, fancy spot in the company garage for, you know, everybody else had Audis and Land Rovers and everything. And I turned up on my bike and I still lived to the same principles. I thought, well, you've got to go to the coalface, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was it. I had a very, and this I think sort of segues with your journey, I was also very spiritually inquisitive. Mm. And it all happened at the age of 11 to 12. So I started my first business at 12. And I made a lot of money making doll's house furniture and library bags and hand-painted cards. And I sold them in really expensive art galleries and toy shops in the nearest town. But at the same time, I took to reading the Bible and I used to go through the yellow pages, you call that? Yeah. The yellow pages here, and looking up different churches. So mum and dad would drive into town each week and go to the Catholic church, and I would research via the yellow pages, and I'd call people with my, you know, 30 cents in the public phone booth.
Wow.
When I was at school, because there was a phone booth near school, and I would find churches to go to. It was the Buddhists, it was the Seventh-day Adventists, the Hare Krishnas, and it was traumatic. I'd come out crying because I still did not understand. I was trying to find an answer to the feeling when I'd turn around and see people's faces looking enthralled, you know?
Yeah.
And so those two things happened at the same time, earning money, and I also became insomniac at that age, and it stayed with me.
Yeah.
That was
intense formative period.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But I want to throw it back onto you in terms of what is the sacred? What is sacred for you?
Yes.
And why that is such an important question to be asking as well.
Yes, I've been asking it since 2017 and I still feel like I don't fully know what it is or what it means to me. You know, it came from actually a real concern about peace building and division and polarization. Mm-hmm. And anthropologist called Scott Atran, who talked about in conflict when we're trying to appeal to each other's left brain, rational, self-optimizing interests. That's the general model for dealing with conflict. Basically, if we can keep everyone happy and people can get as much money or time or status as they want, you can solve it. But most intractable conflicts are not about those things. They're about things that are sacred to us. These deep values, be it land, we see that playing out so tragically in the Middle East, be it about feeling affirmed, right? Acknowledged, seen. And that, you know, in the conversations around abortion, it's not about rational self-interest. It's about this deep commitment about what is sacred, what is a good life, you know, what is the meaning of life. And And then we talk past each other because we don't understand each other's starting points. And so it's really a journey of trying to listen deeply to people and understand beyond the kind of presenting positions or tribes they come from. What's their orientation, right? You know, how are they trying to live? And my answer, I think, is the same. I keep coming back to it, but I think it's about relationship. It's about connection. That's what fully aliveness is. That's what Martin Buber, who's this Jewish philosopher and theologian, talks about I-thou moments, when we really see each other. And you're not an it, you know. You're not Sarah, who functions in this way in my life or in society. You're Sarah, and you're all your fragility and fallibility and depth and beauty, and that ability to really see each other as fully human, which you write about, is what's core and central to me. And I think it has sort of opened up into this sense of relationship makes sense of everything, and that we are, you know, my Christian faith is really important to me, and the understanding of what human being is within my tradition is made in the image of a God who is love before anything else. Like before anything came into being, there was a relationship happening. There was a dance, there was a conversation, there was a family, there was a community within the heart of the divine. And human beings are somehow a reflection of that. So we are designed for relationship. We are designed for community. We are made for each other. We are made by each other. We are connected with the earth, right? And I think what's funny is it's not just theology, it's neuroscience, it's quantum physics, right? As you've written about, like, the weirdness of quantum entanglement.
Yeah.
With this idea of, like, separation is not, doesn't now make any sense. I think that's what's sacred to me.
Yeah. And what about your childhood? I want to come back to some of those points. I think that's going to be our conversation, really. Yeah, but what about your childhood? What informed, what were the sort of the pivotal moments?
So I think the, like, background of my childhood was almost absurdly middle of the road. I had a friend come and visit me and my mum and dad's house when I was a bit older. He said, oh, you grew up in Privet Drive, right? It was small box suburbia, comfortable.
Tidy.
Well, actually not my house, but in general. Like middle of the road, middle class. But I just craved more. I read these novels and I was like, I don't want to be from the commuter belt. I want to be from the wilds of Scotland, right? Or I had this whole thing about wanting Celtic blood, which I have. you know, I want to be a heroine on a journey towards meaning and purpose, and this longing for life to be bigger than it looked like that it was. And I think that's one of the reasons that when I encountered the particular form of Christianity that I did, there was such a hunger. It was like engagement. So that's the big turning point of my childhood was there was background Christianity, maybe a bit like your parents, actually. It was not completely absent.
Yeah.
But I had this powerful, ecstatic encounter through a friend taking me to a big youth festival.
Yeah.
And I went from the world feeling two-dimensional to, like, four-dimensional overnight in a very intense, emotional, knocked-on-the-floor way.
How old were you?
I think I was 14.
Yeah, okay.
I still don't have, like, I haven't pieced the chronology together accurately.
You just know the feeling.
Yeah. I was old enough to have spots and be deeply insecure and be constantly sucking my belly in.
Yeah.
So I think sometime in that early teen years.
I know that era. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting, that's a very interesting nexus, that yearning to find the something more and to find that piece of connection. I know in your book you refer to the idea of acedia. I think you have that word in there.
Yeah.
It's a word that I've also encountered and use in my book to sort of sum up the real nub of what we're missing.
Mm-hmm.
And I pull apart the different types of lonelinesses. And when I was writing this one, Wild and Precious Life, there were all those studies coming out about loneliness.
Mm.
And I think there's a minister for loneliness here in the UK, and there's checkout queues, I think, somewhere in Scandinavia for lonely people and days where they can go shopping. I mean, it's just, it became a thing, a meme somewhat. And I just didn't feel that was what it was, because we're more connected than ever before, ostensibly.
Yeah.
We've got more people in our face. There's more humans on the planet. And what it really, I just sort of drilled it down, it's the loneliness from each other, yes. Mm-hmm. It's the loneliness from ourselves as well.
Yeah.
And it's the loneliness from the kind of connection to the matrix of meaning.
Yeah.
So we've actually become unplugged from the matrix, you know, and that brings about a profound sense of lack.
Mm-hmm.
And you refer to this as a sort of a spiritual distress that saw you go on the journey to become fully alive, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's something, yeah, I think it's palpable and I see it everywhere. That's more of a statement, a sort of a linking statement. But I might segue it into something that I feel I came across in your book as well, that it's sort of following that grief journey, you know. So I almost want to bring it back to the collapse piece, which is you and I both are writing in and around it. You refer to the fact that we've gone from denial to
the stages of grief. So this is from Dougald Hine, and it really helped me. And this is what I really noticed reading your book, is we both started those books with like, I need some spiritual core strength in these times. I need steadiness of soul, right? I'm seeing the future coming towards us and it does not look good on a range of measures. Like, what have we done? What is the world that we've set up? Why are we careering off this cliff? And it really helped me, his sense of like, sometimes you need to move through denial and numbing and sort of nihilistic despair, which is, I think, where people get stuck and where I was sort of spiraling in through grieving, through allowing yourself to grieve. And in my tradition, we call it lament. Like, there are rituals in religious traditions to lament, right? To allow you to grieve and let go, to a kind of acceptance that is not, this is okay, and we can just pretend it's okay, but what is mine to do now?
There's an in-between stage that you pick up on, and that's this idea of bargaining. That's one of the stages in between. And bargaining is where I feel a lot of very well-meaning, caring humans are stuck. So denial was a phase that, you know, I think we're all familiar with. I think a lot of people have moved through that into that bargaining space. And the bargaining space is where a lot of climate activists are positioned. This idea, well, if we can do this, then we can achieve that. If we can all switch to solar panels and wind farms, then we can make it and we can continue business as usual. We can convince everyone around us it's going to be okay, you know, and it's this bargaining with hope. And my next book, which has been serialized on Substack, which is about all of these themes, it's sort of the next step beyond This One Wild and Precious Life, covers this idea of my own journey to let go of hope. And it was a deep, like, it involved incredible grief. Because as a climate activist, to let go of hope as the thing that kind of kept us moving forward, that we could sell in seductively to the people around us, you know, without it, what do we have? And what I find really interesting, of course, that grief journey takes us to acceptance. You know, giving away chapter three, I sort of say the actual salve is to really adult up into truth. And truth actually becomes an incredible relief when we can sit in truth, because what it does is it actually resolves the cognitive dissonance that so many of us are feeling. Hang on, if we're being told that, look, if we do this, we might make it, but then we're also told, hang on, if we go past 1.5, we won't make it, and we're past 1.5, like, what is going on? And that cognitive dissonance is causing incredible amounts of moral injury. And in a post-capitalist world, neoliberal world, where we're meant to shoulder the responsibility for fixing that, it's just causing incredible pain. And so truth, acceptance, you know, it's same, same. There's a space where we can land, which is actually, to me, incredibly sacred. And it's not a fix. Per Jem Bendel, I'm sure you're very familiar with his work, you know, we don't have solutions anymore. We have outcomes and we have to sit with these. So my question really sort of stems from your Christian faith and that move into the Christian faith and the journey you've been on. How are you doing acceptance?
Oh, there's so much in there, Sarah. So I think the first thing to say, and I always want to say, when whatever audience I'm talking to, people will have some really negative associations around that word. And there may be people who were like, Sarah, why are you talking to this woman?
Because, sounds like giving up, doesn't it?
Well, no, I actually mean the Christianity bit.
Oh, the Christianity bit,
is, you know, there are people who carry bruises and wounds and the outcomes of institutional failures. And in some ways, I find myself surprised to be back here finding what I need in this tradition, right? It has come, sometimes comes as a shock to me that this is where I have found the strongest medicine for this moment. But I have. And it's really interesting, as you were talking, I was like, have I given up hope? And I was like, I think hope means something different to me. So the reason I went on this journey and so fully alive was like, I am overwhelmed. I am too often tipping into grief and despair. Therefore, I'm not loving my neighbor. And I set out to try and spend a life loving my neighbor, right? And loving my enemy. These are the, like, ethical call. But when we're in fight or flight anxiety, which you write about so brilliantly, we shut down, you know, we can't do empathy, we can't do listening, we can't do understanding, we just hoard and protect. I was like, I don't want to live like that. I want to find a way to be moving outward. And funnily enough, my tradition, and I'd be really interested in both of our kind of communities of listeners feeding in from other wisdom traditions, because my guess is most religions do this. They go...
in the original form.
Yes, that was certainly Christianity, which is the only thing I have any expertise in, as far as I have any expertise. It's an apocalyptic religion, right? I was reading a piece in...
Scripture. That's so interesting.
Yeah, in my scripture yesterday, and it's from Peter, and it says that 1 Peter, the end of all things is near. Therefore, love each other deeply and practice hospitality without grumbling. Right?
Without grumbling?
Without grumbling. It's like, wow, the end of the world is coming. So what you should do is you should move towards each other. Love each other deeply. Practice hospitality. And all of this book was written with the assumption that the world was ending. Jesus was coming back soon. And what should you do? You should love your neighbor and love your enemy. You should put your roots down deep. You should seek to be growing in faith and hope and love and goodness and patience and kindness, not picking up your guns and building yourself a prepper bunker.
And
right?
Canning.
Exactly. Or canning for the good of your neighbors.
Yes.
Right? I'm like, okay, I have some prepper tendencies. I need to recover my ancestral knowledge. I need to learn how to grow food. We've moved into this small community to try and live more sustainably and in networks of mutual care. But my tradition says to me, all of that has to be in service of your neighbor, of others, because we are each other's safety.
Yes.
We are each other's home. And my sense has been always that there have been other ends of the world, right? There have been like plagues, the fall of Jerusalem, the fall of Rome, the Holocaust, right? Humans have lived through ends of the world.
And it's not always the end of the world or sort of it's the end of incredibly profound ideas that humanity has clung to and felt they would not survive without it.
Exactly. Yeah. Systems, structures, cultural stories of what we were. I was raised in my middle class, middle of the road life, that I would have a nice middle class, middle of the road life, right? And there would be prosperity.
And systems, infinite growth.
Infinite growth. And I could self-express myself and really not be in discomfort or awkwardness or need to fend for myself in any way.
And life would only get less uncomfortable because that is what we're here for, to remove discomfort.
That's fully aliveness. And so what I have found in my tradition is this both very stark, you were never promised that the world would go on forever. You were never promised stable democracy, comfortable prosperity, like the early church lived through, much the opposite of that. What you were promised is that love is stronger than death. That there is something underneath all these systems and these human idols and these ways we fuck up, which is another way I define sin. Human propensity to fuck things up. All the ways we disconnect, which is another way I think about sin. Something beyond that, and there's something under it. And so my hope is not that we can save ourselves as humans. I just don't think that was ever the promise, but that there is something, that there is love, right, to catch us. And that when we can move through the terror into relationship with each other, I have this funny thing that actually there is one way this goes, which is we remember who we're supposed to be and we live in ways that are actually more life-giving anyway.
Yeah, that's the gift. And I know we both use that word. I've sort of been holding off from using that word in the journey that I've been going on with this book serialization about collapse. But, you know, to give away the end, what it delivers us to is our full humanness.
Yeah.
You know, which is one of your questions, right? I think I'm just going to get it up here. If it is the end of the world, what kind of people do we need to be becoming?
Yeah.
And in the continuing present sense of becoming.
Hi, I wondered if I could ask for your help. You may have noticed that we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make this channel more beautiful, more enriching, more thought-provoking, and more life-giving. But 87% of you watching on this channel are not yet subscribed. So I wondered if you would just hit the little subscribe button. It means that you'll get these really thoughtful conversations in your feed, and it will also help other people find us. Thanks very much. Yeah, and I find that question really, really helpful. It's from Vanessa Zoltan, who's an atheist chaplain and thinker who does a lot of reading secular books as sacred. I like it because it puts the if there, because I need to hold the future as a mystery and not assume that I know what's going to happen.
Yes.
Anything could happen. But then go, is, and it's that sort of serenity prayer from the recovery movement, you know, help me have the courage to change the things I can, but also the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And the main thing I have agency over is my reaction, right?
Yeah.
Where I put my spiritual roots, how I choose to respond, like what is the things I'm going to spend my attention on so that they can form me. And I want to be formed into faith, hope, and love. I want to be formed into communities that flourish. I want to be formed into someone who can love their neighbor. And I'm not actually that person because I am lazy and easily annoyed and distracted by my phone, mainly, right?
Yeah.
So I want to be part of a story in a community that can help me be becoming that kind of person. So I'm like, if it is the apocalypse, then we're going to need people, one, with some practical skills, and two, who are not panicking and running around with their pants on their head, but are like, right, we can do this. Like your family, how are we going to fix things with what we've got? How are we going to share what we have? How are we going to grow enough food to feed us all?
Yeah. I think you said that you wanted to be, and I'm just trying to find the wording on it, actually. It was some really great wording on who you want. Your ambition is to be a non-anxious presence, be the kind of person who would have hidden the Jews from the Nazis.
Yeah. It's ambitious, given my current character, but I do.
You wouldn't have had an iPhone to distract you back then, so I don't know.
Because some people did.
They did. They rose.
They put their lives on the line. Mm. I'm not that yet. I'd like to be that by the time I die.
I really like that answer because it does recognise that that is a practice and it is really hard. That is the art of humaning, you know, is to actually become that person and firstly to acknowledge that you're not there yet. I also like the way that you referred to almost a sense of self-conscious vanity around the idea that you want to be a luminous presence as well. And I get that. Yeah, I get that because I know that people say to me, like my mother actually sent me a message. She contacts me about once or twice a year. And her message was, I just do not understand with all the information that you're engaged in at the moment. I'd gone home to visit. Mm-hmm. I'd talked her through it. She's deeply Catholic. Mm-hmm. And it really, really confronted her what I was working on. My father can hold it.
Yeah.
He's fired up for it. He's got warrior spirit. He's like, right, well, what do I need to do
and be?
Sounds
like he's always been going, how do we?
He's very much like that. And my mother gets very overwhelmed. And she said, how is it that you look so happy? Hmm. And it really, really confounded her. And a number of people in my life are like that. Mm-hmm. They're like, you seem to be okay around this. And I have to say that one of the things that I do, and it is tapping into that egoic idea of becoming something that you've always wanted to be and have wanted to rise to, and that is, you use the beautiful word luminous, you know. I think the word warrior is wonderful. Meg Wheatley talks about being an island of sanity. Mm. And it's, the sense I have is that there's going to have to be more of us that embody that. Mm. And for me, that gets me out of bed.
Yeah.
Like that is a more of a sturdy, honest, true, congruent, attuned way of being than trying to peddle hope, which is what I used to have to rely on.
I would love to hear more about how your spirituality helps you find spiritual core strength in these times. What does it mean for you to do that? And you talk about full fat spirituality, not spirituality light. What does it look
like? Yeah, okay, that's a good reminder. So this is sort of by way of answering the question that I kind of danced around and said I'd come back to, the what kind of people do we need to be becoming if it is in fact the end of the world? I mean, to a certain extent, I think that what we need to be becoming is simply more human. Fully, fully human. Mm. And it's not much more complicated than that.
What do you mean by it?
It's a remembering. It's a returning. It's stripping back. It's being. And so what do we do from there? Because that sounds great and I think it resonates. And even when I say it to myself, I can feel tears, you know, because it feels familiar, you know. So what does it feel like? Like, what do I do that? The obligation, the next steps from there? We need to actually go into spaces. We need to actually vigilantly and deliberately be in spaces around people, in environments where we do remember, where we are reminded, where we see, I've used this word way too many times in this interview, but congruence. And the simple shortcut is be in nature. I think nature can teach us about the patternings, our original patternings, how we belong, where we belong. And the how is really important. The how of nature. I mean, I sometimes sit with a tree, or actually a mountain is the most powerful place for me, is sitting on a mountain and I'm with the mountain and I feel that we're looking out to the horizon together. Mm. And it's just this absolute stillness and beingness and acceptance and all these clumsy words that we overlay. But that just brings me right down, right down. And look, having space between you and the next thing is wonderful for putting things into perspective. High ceilings in churches do the same thing, that awe, you know, and that can bring us really down into all of that. But I think, yeah, we need to remember and return to who we are. We need to unfuck the fuck-uppery, you know. and that's simple. And I think it comes as a huge relief to people. So my spiritual journey, I suppose, has been, I mean, spirituality aids me through that. And I know that you've done the same, the people in your life have done the same, have done the dance around trying different things. But to sort of pick up on that phrasing that you've quoted back at me, my own words back at me about sort of full fat spiritualism. When I wrote this One Wild and Precious Life, I was aware how a lot of people around me were trying to cope with the overwhelm and everything that was going on, their guilt, their shame of being a human that had caused this sin. Mm-hmm. We'd fucked up, you know, by doing a very diet version of spirituality, which was to go to the yoga class and get the nice stretching and the good vibes afterwards, and meditating to feel like a sort of a euphoric, expansive feeling, but then walking outside and stepping over the homeless person, you know. It's about cherry picking from all the traditions, the things that actually make us feel good, which is great. That is, all the spiritual traditions have provided that. They've provided a wisdom and a guidance to make us feel less alone in our spiritual distress and acedia and loneliness. But part of that, what we've been missing, what we've been kind of cutting out, is the sacrifice. Mm. Every spiritual tradition has had an element of sacrifice. And it's not about just, you know, hardship and flagellating oneself with a, you know, soggy cabbage leaf for the sake of it. It is because we only get to that openness required to have true acceptance and true connection through some kind of grist, you know? And part of the reason we're in the predicament we're in today is because we are a culture that has eradicated all discomfort. You know, I read somewhere, and I wrote about this in that book, This One Wild and Precious Life, that something like 70 to 90% of all technology that has been created in the last 30 years has been geared at getting rid of discomfort.
Yeah.
So it's not been about making the world a better place or solving the climate crisis or the nuclear.
Solving real problems.
Correct. It is about creating a cocooning from the reality of real life, you know, and that is has done us a huge disservice.
Mm.
And that is part of that growth improvement mindset that we've all bought into.
Yeah.
And yet it is the very thing that is preventing us from going to this very space that we need to get the thing that we're seeking through the comfort, which is a sense of belonging and peace and truth.
Yeah.
It's like wrong way, go back, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel that the spiritual traditions have always reminded me of that missing element.
Yeah.
The hardship is good.
Yeah.
You know, if you're feeling vulnerable, if you're feeling uncomfortable, then it means shit is real.
Yeah.
And I remember I interviewed Brené Brown many, many years ago, and we were talking about this, and she was saying that when she feels uncomfortable at something, she has a hair elastic, as most women do on their wrist. Yeah, as you do right now. Mine's in my hair at the moment. But she twangs it and says, okay, this is uncomfortable. It means we're heading somewhere.
Yeah.
And that phrase has really stuck with me. And those are the learnings that the spiritual traditions, the religious traditions, focused on. Mm-hmm. They remind, as did mythology, as did fairy tales, as did heroes' journeys. They reminded us the hardship is good. Yeah. The hardship is part of this process.
Yeah, because we've bought a lie that comfort brings us joy. And it might bring us fleeting pleasure, but it doesn't bring us a sense of meaning and purpose and fully aliveness.
Well, it brings a terrible sense of acedia,
yeah.
Which is that foggy-headed, just, you know, not enough air getting... You know how I describe it in the book? And it's because it's just very evocative for me. Christmas Day in Australia is stinking hot, but yeah. It might as well be here in the UK where you'll shut your windows down it's and it's bloody.
Yeah.
And it's so, you know, suffocating. You've eaten too much lunch. And, you know, your sister-in-law says, shall we go for a bit of a walk to walk off lunch? And you're like, I just can't.
Yeah.
I just want to stay here and watch reruns of, you know, what is it? Hey Dad or, yeah. You know, Everyone Loves Raymond or something. Yeah. So whatever it is that's on television on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
So I do not want to move. I just want to stay on this couch. And that's acedia, yeah. Where you've lost that vibrancy, the luminosity, you know, yeah. Like that is what we need.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and again, going out into discomfort, going out into nature brings you online to all of those things. You have the breeze, you know, that creates vibrancy. You can see things. You can see you get perspective at who you are amongst everything else, you know. Staying in that cocooned state is the antithesis of everything that you and I are talking about that I think most humans are aching for.
Yeah, I always think of the Pixar film WALL-E, where humans have left the Earth because it's too full of rubbish and they're just in a spaceship and they have adult buggies and people deliver them food and their faces are strapped to... It's a huge mass population regression that we are in the middle of, and it makes me want to go for a run and fast for more technology and remember what I am capable of, right? I'm not an adult baby. I don't need to be protected from being a human. And it's as we lean into actually our courage and our skill and our vulnerability, but our vulnerability in healthy communities,
yeah,
that I'm finding closer to the thread. I know lots of people come to you and say, okay, thank you for like opening my eyes to this and being honest about it. What do I actually do? What's the key question that people are coming to you with?
Yeah, that's a really good question because it's very alive for me at the moment. So I do these one-on-one sessions via Substack. And people can book in just basically to pick my brains on something that I've either written about or thereafter advice about their life. I feel somewhat like I have imposter syndrome around it, but I suppose we're at a point in history, aren't we, where people are seeking out different types of guides.
Give what you've got to give.
That's it. So I've probably done about 20 to 25 of these sessions so far, and they run for an hour, and it's people from all around the world. But I can tell you they are all women aged around about 38 to 51, 52, so women mostly in their 40s. They're an A-type of woman. They're incredibly caring, often got children, juggling all kinds of things. They've had an incredible career, and their question is the same every single time without fail, and that is, I have had a great career. I've achieved everything that my generation was told I had to achieve, you know, beating the boys, ticking off all these boxes in life. And I know I need to be of service. I know that I'm at a point in history where I need to step up into something. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to do it. And our strategizing binary left brains go, well, what I need to do is do a career change and I need to start a podcast and I need to start a Substack and I need to do all these things, you know. And my general kind of advice, the journey that we go on together is I quote Pema Chodron here, I say, listen, the smartest thing you can do is start where you are. And if you are a nurse, if you are a lawyer, if you're working in corporate HR, there is so much work to do in all those fields. We are all seeking people who are, you know, being that is those, you know, islands of sanity, who are able to be in these spaces. I think you feel very much the same. I'm looking at your living environment. You've chosen to live in, it's not central London, but it's London, you know.
Yeah.
You've found a space that's still within the huge heaving masses of humanity, and you've found these place where you can have a garden. You get to do it by sharing it with other people. I suspect you're the same as me. I do not want to be out prepping. I want to be where the humans are who are hurting and struggling. And that So start where you are. Yeah. Start where everyone is. Start where you're with what you're already doing. There's not enough time for us to do this massive shape shift. Mm. We do not have the moral courage to actually go and be something completely different. Mm. We need to be in this now, doing it now. And most of these women are already doing it,
yeah.
But they feel that it's got to look somewhat yeah. different. So, yeah, that's a question that I get asked all the time. And again, the answer is so much simpler. It's a returning to that which we know is our true essence. But one thing I'll add to that, Elizabeth, is that I feel that I guess it's more of a question. I find myself concluding from watching this patterning that women of a certain age, so our generation, I think we're about a decade apart, but it's that generation. Yeah. I feel that we are women who grew up in the earnest 90s, I was more the 80s, where we were the last generation to not have any connection, you know, who know life before the internet. Mm. We also experienced a huge recession. We grew up in a recession.
Yeah.
And we also grew up with a sense that things, wouldn't always be easy.
Mm.
I think also something happens with women where maybe you come out of your childbearing years and you realize that there's a different type of wisdom that the world is needing. Mm. And even my father said to me, he said, I think the future is going to have to be feminine, Sarah.
Mm.
And this is a guy who has resisted this. We have had fights about the gender pay gap for decades. Mm. You know, I've dragged him to sort of feminist thinking over the years. But he's just looked around, and I know Will Ferrell did something very similar at some awards night at some stage, and he just went, women need to run the world. He said, look, it's black and white.
We
haven't got it right. Whatever we've done, we've not got it right. So, yes, your turn. It's like, yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, the poison chalice. Yeah, we'll clean up your mess now. But leaving aside those, you know, crass ideas, I think there is definitely a sense women, for whatever reason, are feeling like this is the moment to step forward and be of service.
Mm.
And we're feeling it very, very deeply. And for anyone listening, you're not alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think, it's a very important process to work out what it is that you feel you should be doing.
Yeah.
How do you feel? Do you feel that same sense? Are you feeling that in your community? Are you feeling that palpable sense that people are wanting to step up into something?
Honestly, I think I'm listening into slightly different conversations. The people who I spend most of my time talking to are either sort of mainstream secular activists and change makers.
Yes.
Who've been working on the environment or social cohesion or whatever, or people who, mainly Christians, but not exclusively, who've been in religious spaces. And honestly, both of those groups are like, I've spent 20 years trying to be of service and now I'm a husk.
Got it. Yeah.
Right. And
and climate activists would feel in that space too.
It's hugely. Like, how do I sustain myself? Like, how do I sustain hope? Or how do I come to acceptance? Or how do I, and some people who are like, okay, yes, I've ticked off the boxes and now I want to be of service more broadly. But I think my theme is always, and I was thinking as you were speaking earlier about remembering, that the word member is a bodily metaphor, and that it literally means put a body back together, like the members of the body. That remember is a reunification and bringing back together parts that have been ripped apart.
Yeah.
And I always come back to that. So the main question I get asked is, how do I find community? That's obviously because I'm sort of publicly living in this slightly weird way. But under so much, whether it's the people who are like, I've been trying to change the world and now I'm burnt out, or the people who are like, I'm becoming aware of these problems and now I want to help, or the fact that everyone's probably a mix of both of those.
It's the same drive. I think we're speaking to the same people because a lot of these women are climate activists or, have been in that space and have gone, what I was fighting for is no longer possible. Where do I go now?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I similarly have imposter syndrome in the sense of I don't know, but my kind of deep values are always orienting me back to, where shall we go into relationship? Like, where shall we go towards love? Like that, you know, the end of all things is nigh, therefore love each other deeply and practice hospitality. And I think part of the reason that the people who've been trying to sound the alarm or or in their different fields, like whatever the bit of the world that you've been trying to fix or you've been aware of is, feel so burnt out and worn out is this underlying logic of individualism that we carry it on our shoulders, that we are the agents of change ourselves. And this move that I find life-giving is back into community, back into a sense of who do I know when I'm known by? Who am I living up close with? Who what are the names of the people on my street and what do they need? Like a quite a local turn, actually. And I never know if it's cowardice or if it's realistically what we're going to need in the time to come. And we saw it a bit in COVID, is local networks of interdependence and trust.
Yeah.
Into each other, I think the same thing happens there, is that we have resisted the awkwardness and the discomfort of being in real relationships with people because people are annoying.
They are.
I'm also annoying. Mm. Like tolerating being annoyed and realizing that actually the solution is not to build bigger and bigger houses and more fences. It's to come through the discomfort into intimacy and into relationship. And that's what I'm always trying to say. Lower your expectations of community and build it anyway. Like release your idealism and your romance and your rosy tinted spectacles, because they will go up in absolute flames.
Yeah.
And do it anyway, because we need each other and we have to be up close with each other, because we were never designed to live like this. It is causing us existential angst and spiritual distress.
I love that phrase, do it anyway. And I use it in a slightly different way when people are like, well, what's the point? You know, oh God, if I do this and if I do this, it's not going to make any difference. And the path that I think you and I are in our clumsy, awkward, imposter syndrome kind of way going along, clambering along, you know, with white knuckles at times, trying to go, release the grip,
surrender.
Yeah. Well, there's going to be nothing to lose by doing this, you know? Like, it's what we want to be doing anyway. We want to feel softer. We want to feel more connected. Love is a pretty cool thing. Curiosity is another characteristic. Curiosity, kindness, and awe both open up a part of the brain that actually brings in huge amounts of well-being and joy. Mm-hmm. And for obvious reasons, that's probably all three are very critical to our survival on the planet. Curiosity is a really important one to bear in mind, I think, with all of this as well, because I think it's an antidote to giving up and becoming ascetic.
Yeah.
Curiosity is important. And it's really interesting. The more that the world has become opulent and, you know, the rising ships, was it rising waters lift all ships, all that kind of stuff, the growth thing, the more that the world has, you know, got seduced by this notion of growth, the less innovative it's become, the less creative it's become, and less curious it's become. Yeah. And there's been a bunch of, you know, studies that have been, that have shown this direct link. Curiosity is an incredible antidote to that, well, what's the pointness?
Yeah.
And do it anyway, you know, because
it's an adventure.
It is an adventure. It is an absolute adventure. And once again, when you succumb to the discomfort, when you succumb, and succumb's a negative word, but I think if we can think of it as a term of relief, if we can relinquish, release into the not knowing, it does become an adventure. Yeah. You know, my meditation teacher who passed away a little over a year ago, he used to say to me, Sarah, keep the camera rolling. And he said, let us see what happens next. Let us, you, me, and the universal flow, see what happens next. And that to me, that's just delightful, right?
It's a possibility.
It's a possibility, and it's like, wow, I'm curious to know what happens next, and I just want to keep dancing with it, keep the dance going, you know.
Can I ask you a question that I think that won't be awkward, but some people have some triggers around, given that we've talked about discomfort.
I have no triggers. It's all right.
Great. And it is about religion itself, because one of the things I'm really playing with is, can we do this without it? You know, I'm someone who was sort of on the outside of a religious tradition and then in it, and then tried to be an atheist and saw all the nonsense, and they call it deconstruction now, was like, oh, only stupid people are into this. I was very judgy. I was young. And then have like found my way back into what feels a more livable and spacious and wise and gracious stream. But most of my friends are not religious, and they're asking the same questions. And I'm in a moment of going, the anti-individualistic container,
yeah,
feels to me very much for such a time as this, even though the institutions are so disappointing and so failing, and Christians, including me, are just like rabid hypocrites. What's your thinking about that? Because I feel like there's more people saying, maybe we wrote this off too soon. Are you hearing that too?
Yeah, I'm not hearing it necessarily. However, I feel it. I've never, ever released my faith, but I didn't go to a Catholic school. My father was quite anti-authoritarian. You know, I used to question the nuns, the priests, you know, and so on. And I fought with our local priest to become an altar boy. I thought it was ridiculous.
Did he let you?
No, of course not. It's a Catholic church in the 1980s.
I'm imagining
early 80s.
You now dressed up in drag, like slicked back hair.
I was furious. But Father Drinkwater it was.
God bless him.
He needs it, trust me. I mean, it's Nietzsche, you know, claimed that we couldn't do it without religion. That wasn't quite his message, but it was sort of, you know, that's how people have interpreted his message. I feel that religion always existed to provide the moral guardrails. We do not have the moral certitude and capacity at an individual level to make the kind of moral decisions required to ensure human individualism doesn't run rampant. To survive, we need to be individualistic. We need to make sure we feed ourselves and our immediate family. But we also need to have a respect and sense of the community and the collective, because we don't run very fast. We don't have fangs. We don't have a sting in our tail. We don't have horns. We are some of the most vulnerable creatures on the planet. Again, Nietzsche said that as well. And he salved to that. He said, what is it? I think humans are the sickliest animals on the planet. Our only solution is to return to nature. But what we've done is we got vertical on 2 feet. Our prefrontal cortex expanded. We were able to become smarter and smarter. We developed communication skills that allowed us to cooperate and coordinate and build community. Language and mythology then was able to, it was able to then keep us not only surviving, but quote unquote, rising to the top of the food chain. And so ideally we have the individualistic instinct and then that collective instinct. We have it in a sweet balance, you know, the Goldilocks formula. And what religion did throughout the ages was provide, I guess, those boundaries to ensure we kept the two in balance and one didn't run, you know, rampant and the other get neglected. And that is the perfect formula for ensuring human, you know, prosperity. So I feel that that is very much lacking, because as we've destroyed not only religion but other institutions, the scouting movement, other community groups. Neighbourhoods. As we've got rid of those, I sort of refer to it as we got rid of the moral umpires off the footy field of life. And when you get rid of the umpires, you do not have a fun game, right? When it's a free-for-all, like a game of football is not fun without rules. You know, we need to be bound. We absolutely do, because we have selfish instincts. Animals have other needs. They don't need what we need. And that's why we evolved to have these kind of, moral guardrails and umpires. So can we do it without religion? Religion has throughout history been the best kind of forum for this.
Because and sometimes the worst.
And it then, regresses because, you know, power instinct and corruption and so on. But what religion does is it's always provided a mythology, a story that we all cling to and we can move forward with. You know, you referred to what Peter said, you know, his idea of, what was it about the
end of all things is nigh, love each other deeply and practice hospitality.
The hospitality piece. I mean, a line like that is enough to inspire nations, you know, and it's enough to steer us away from the desire to, you know, to eat everything for ourselves, keep everything for ourselves. So, yeah, religion I think has a wonderful, and again, I sort of go back to, well, do we have time to invent anything else? You know, the scriptures are there. They've done a wonderful job. And I think we, I think it's been finely calibrated over thousands of years to include that real, again, sweet spot between feeling good and the sacrifice, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. I still do think that nature can also teach us. And that was the sort of, that was the path or the sort of the thesis that I had in This One Wild and Precious Life. I hiked around the world for 3 years in the footsteps of many of these minds and voices who asked similar questions and provided the wisdoms to actually encourage people to go into nature, because I think nature can teach us most of what we need. Yeah. It's about getting into that slipstream, the patterning, the isness of it, the stillness of it, the pure acceptance of it. I think it actually is one way. But yes, look, a lot of non-religious thinking, spiritual traditions are nature-based, you know? So yeah, that would be my answer. I think we can, and I think nature can actually lead us.
So, you know, we've gone deep. I love it. Philosophy, theology, neuroscience. For those listening who think, okay, what does it mean for me in my ordinary life, just trying to get through my to-do list, to meet the challenge of this moment, to be becoming the kind of person the world needs? Where should they start?
Well, I think really pragmatic things are anything that can get you still and aware and noticing and paying attention. You know, Teju Cole, the activist and poet, said, the role of an artist is to get us all to concentrate more. And I think that's actually something that we can actually do. We don't have to wait for anyone. We can choose to concentrate more. And I actually find when I apply, you know, that thinking to my terrible addiction to my phone and my ability to be eternally distracted, it feels, I'm fired up for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I, you know, when I ran the I Quit Sugar business, I said, no human ever has quit something by someone telling them not to do it. It's like I see a, you know, wet paint sign, do not touch. All I want to do is touch it, right? Yeah. So you've got to find framings and mindsets that actually resonate and actually feel original and human, super, super human. So, yeah, if I know that my obligation is to concentrate more and to pay attention to life as a vigilant practice, then coming off social media and putting my phone away feels kind of part of that seeking of the luminous and the warrior spirit. And
that's like everything starts from there.
It helps my ego get there. Yeah. Another mindset that I've found that's really resonated in the process of writing this book, and it really helped me, is this idea of Moloch. Moloch was the Hebrew god where you could sacrifice your child to this god, and they would give you a win in a war, in a battle, which of course is just terrible because it's a lose-lose situation, because you sacrifice the thing that you're trying to win the war for, right?
Yeah.
And that's where we're at in the world today with AI, nuclear threat, social media. We are trapped in this lose-lose downward spiral game. And it's a game in theory now where, all right, the example would be with nuclear threat. No country is going to say, right, we're going to get rid of all our nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
We're going to do it because it's the right thing to do, because they're already in the arms race.
Yeah.
And if they do it, they lose. They're vulnerable. But because we're all in the arms race, we're spending billions of dollars a year on creating weapons that will wipe us all out.
Mm-hmm.
If one country drops a bomb, we are either dead or living in a permanent nuclear winter. And we are in this Moloch game in so many ways, including with the climate crisis, including with all of the things we feel trapped by, including social media.
Mm-hmm.
So that framing helps, because what it does is it actually sets it up as no one is to blame and everyone is to blame, and it wipes blame off the table.
Yeah.
And I think when we get rid of blame, we then realize, and the fact there's nothing we can do, it's too far gone.
Yeah.
We've missed the deadline. We fucked up. And then that opens up the space, my heart, I think many people's hearts and spirits, to, and now what?
Yeah.
and now what? Yeah. And that's when we can get so clear and magnificent and vigilant and focused on all of the things that you've covered off, the community, the connection, the love, because that is what is left.
Yeah, that's so helpful.
What about for you? What practice? I mean, for me, meditation, walking in nature, it works. Yeah. People say to me, what's your favourite hike? I'm like, the next one.
Yeah.
They never fail. Don't worry.
Like, whatever
you'll
it
never
is,
have to use your warranty, you know, and get a refund. Yeah. It works. It works. It works. I've never had a bad hike.
Yeah.
Just do it and let it. You don't have to think about it. Just do it and it'll work its magic on you. You'll get home and something will have shifted. So hiking, meditation, and I have another phrase, which is another mindset shift. Eric Fromm has a phrase, he makes his life a practice in work and love. Mm-hmm. And work, I feel at the age of almost 51, I've kind of done.
Mm-hmm.
I will keep doing it. You know, like I'm fired up to work for a very long time.
Yeah.
But it's love is something that I have to be vigilant and I have to practice it and I have to be in it and see it as a beautiful, curious adventure.
Yeah. Hmm. So for me, I think the mindset shift, the frame, mindset shift and the frame that changed it for me was this understanding of sin, which is this word that I have found surprisingly useful. There's a phrase that's used by St. Augustine and Luther, which in Latin is homo incurvatus in se, which means humanity turned in on itself, like an ingrowing toenail, right? And when I came to understand that the temptation of all human lives probably, and particularly at the moment, to turn in on ourselves and withdraw from each other, to disconnect from each other, from the earth and from divine love, that was what shook me out of this acidiac numbing into, okay, what does it mean to do the opposite? What does it mean to grow towards connection and relationship and fully aliveness? Practically, what that actually means is committing to other people over time.
Okay.
And so the bit of us that's wants full individual control over our schedules, wants always to have the option to pull out at the last minute, does not want to be transparent about our finances, does not want to be seen at our worst, wants control, is, I think, a temptation, is what pride is, actually. And full humanity is when we move towards each other and we say, you're a mess, I'm a mess, we're in a mess, but we're going to travel together.
Yeah.
And so on the very basic level, the advice I often give to people is, have an honest, raw conversation with your friends, your best friends who you actually trust, and say, what are the rhythms and rituals collectively we could set up and commit to over time? Maybe we actually will genuinely move closer to each other. Maybe we will have one meal a week together. Maybe we will put aside a certain amount of time to be together, fully human, trying to move towards life together. And we established some new norms where you can't just flake. You've said it, like, leave your phone at home so you can't text someone and say, I'm running a bit late. And like, take your commitments to each other seriously. Covenant together. Resist the bit of this, like, but it's not comfortable. It's not convenient. It gets in the way. It doesn't.
And this is the sacrifice part of religious traditions, by the way. Sacrifice isn't about, you know, cutting off your nose to spite a face.
No.
It's doing things that are uncomfortable to connect.
Short-term discomfort. And not even discomfort, it's inconvenience, short-term inconvenience, which we've been trained out of for the good of the good that we want to define our lives, which in my case is relationship. And so my one, like, where can you start with this stuff is be the earnest weirdo prepared to seem needy by inviting people into collective commitments of community and relationship. And I guarantee you, some people were like, no. And more than half of people will go, oh, thank goodness, what a relief.
Yeah.
Thank you for starting.
Be messy.
Yeah.
Choose the wobbliest table at the cafe, which is another phrase that I've used in one of my books. Like, go to messy. Actually use that to get used to this mindset.
Yeah.
I had to.
It's not gonna
I had
you.
To practice going to the messy, grimmest, wrongest cafe, choosing the place in the draft, under the speaker, hating on it all, and then seeing what happens, you know.
Sitting under fluorescent lights is actually fine.
But and marvellous things happen. They just do when you go to that messy place.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the time. Yeah. I know that we have to wrap up, don't we?
So.
I've so enjoyed that. I have a question that I do use, and I think really we've covered it off, but if you had a short answer to it, I ask it at the end of some of my interviews, and it's, what is left if we lose it all?
Mm.
I suspect you know exactly what I mean. Some of my guests get really stumped by that question, and they sort of get very, very literal with trying to work out exactly what I'm trying to say. But is there something that you would say maybe as just a rounder outer answer to that question?
Yeah, there's a bit from the Song of Solomon, and it was a reading that I had at my wedding, our wedding with my husband. And it ends with, love is stronger than death. And that is my deepest hope, that if nothing else remains, love is faithful and perseveres.
Mm. My answer is exactly the same, love. Yeah.
Yeah. Sarah Wilson, thank you so much for doing this hybrid collab today. It's been
Elizabeth
a joy.
Oldfield, back at you. It was wonderful. It's one of my favourite conversations I've had in a long time.
Thank you, me too. Wow. Sarah is obviously a force of nature. Her mind works so fast. And it was you will be able to see how much I'm kind of shifting between being used to being the interviewer or the interviewee, and trying to relax into just having a conversation where we talk to each other and draw each other out. But some themes, a couple of themes really, really stuck with me. One was this sense of how much discomfort can we hold? You know, how much tension, how much paradox. I was speaking to someone recently called Jenna, and I hope I can find out what her surname was so I can credit her properly in the show notes. But she said this extraordinary thing to me, which was, you know, there's so much paradox and complexity and nuance in all of these wisdom paths, in all of these seeking to grow up our souls, right? And she said, there are, in physics, I think there is this measure of PSI, which is basically how much pressure can a container hold, how much atoms pulling apart from each other can a container hold. And she said, we really just need to be trying to increase the PSI of our soul. And it reminded me of this quote by Parker Palmer that I love. And he says, those who can hold tension in a heart-opening way basically will be able to be some use in the world. And yeah, the idea that we can actually tolerate discomfort, we can tolerate tension, we can tolerate paradox, we can tolerate uncertainty, which ran through so much of this. And I think I probably feel less, slightly less certain than Sarah. You know, she uses this phrase about collapse. Maybe I'm still in denial. I wrote a Substack that I wrote the other day, you know, are you a doomer or a denier? And it really just depends what day you catch me, who I've been listening to, how resilient I'm feeling in myself. What story I'm immersing myself in. But yes, the certainly the tension and the what can be very anxiety provoking, and you may have found yourself provoked to anxiety listening to this episode. I hope that it felt like a safe container to kind of carry that. But it feels really key to me as we try and grow up our souls. I was really interested in this phrase post-hope that she uses, you know, get beyond hope. I just don't know that I ever want to get past hope, but as I was trying to explain, my hope isn't really in this particular structure of society, right? This particular system, even in, do I believe this? This is interesting. Even in my own survival, I think I do believe this, that what I try and attach my hope to is something deeper and longer term and stronger. And we landed right at the end on what that is, I think, for both of us, maybe from different traditions with slightly different language, but it is about love. It's about interconnectedness. It's about relationship, about community, communion even. And every time I go there and every time I land back there with someone, and, you know, often when I ask people what's sacred to them, they say something like love. And one of the very earliest conversations we had on the sacred, back when our production values were embarrassingly low, is with Francis Spufford, who wrote Unapologetic. And he has reframed this concept of sin to the human propensity to F things up. And I draw on that a lot. But I asked him, could you do the same for love, please? Because there is this fundamental concept, this fundamental yearning, this fundamental hunch that so many people have, that there is a deep logic in the universe. And the best word we have for it is love, but that word has got so semiotically evacuated. You know, it's a bit of an empty shell now through overuse. Maybe we need to retire it for a while and let it get its luster back. Yeah, many, many thoughts coming out of that conversation. I'd be really interested to hear what you thought. And you can find Sarah in all the places that we'll put in the show notes. Her Substack is called This Is Precious. Thank you so much for listening to me on today's episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield. Our production team are Dan Turner, Amari Ugandrin, and Lizzie Harvey. And we are a project of the think tank Theos. I'd love you to go check out our wider work, including our sister podcast, reading our times. Please do get in touch. I have a personal website. My Substack is more fully alive at substack.com. Find me on social media. I'm trying to be more boundaried with it, but I probably will see it eventually. Or drop us an email as a team. Otherwise, I look forward to speaking to you on our next episode.